Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. The White House has sent the Senate a new FBI background file on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, giving senators a day to digest the confidential material and make a decision on the nomination before a first vote on Friday. Brett Kavanaugh's nomination has stirred passions not normally seen over a Supreme Court nomination. A new poll out from Reuters today found whether you support or oppose the Kavanaugh nomination depends a lot on political affiliation. Opposition to Kavanaugh stood at 71% amongst Democrats. Support among Republicans stood at 70%. This hour, we're going to discuss that political divide and how it affects the Supreme Court. Joining me now are two experts. Aziz Huq is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and the author of a new book, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Welcome, Professor.
Hi. Glad to be on the show, Stephanie.
And Laura Undercuffler is a professor of law at Cornell Law School. Welcome, Professor, also.
Thank you very much.
We also want to hear from you. Have the Kavanaugh hearings affected your image of the Supreme Court? Do you see the court as above politics and impartial still? Join our conversation at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. Aziz, I'm going to start with you. We've seen contentious Supreme Court hearings before. There's even a verb affiliating with it, to be borked. Does this moment strike you as more politically oppositional than usual?
I think the general political moment is oppositional because the degree and the effects of divisions between the two main political parties are greater than at any time in modern history.
Do you think that this will, how will this affect the Supreme Court itself? Is it playing out there? If whether Kavanaugh gets nominated or not, put on the Supreme Court or not, do you think that the political division that is happening right now will affect the court itself?
The court is held in higher regard by Americans than other national institutions such as Congress and the presidency. And the regard that Americans hold the court in doesn't seem to be affected by controversial cases. So, for example, Bush v. Gore, a case that effectively decided the 2000 presidential election, did not have a great effect upon levels of public confidence in the court. Nonetheless, over the last 20 years, the secular trend in confidence in the Supreme Court has been declining. And given the polarized nature of responses to the Kavanaugh nomination, I would anticipate that whether or not Justice Kavanaugh is ever appointed to the court, we would expect to see that secular decline continue and perhaps accelerate.
Laura, do you think it matters if the United States population starts seeing the Supreme Court more like Congress, where almost like 40% of people have little faith in Congress? Does it matter if we have little faith in the Supreme Court?
I think it matters a great deal. The Supreme Court is an interesting institution in that until this time, its decisions and processes and personages and so forth have all been held in relative esteem, as Aziz mentioned, by the public, even if the particular decisions are something which people vehemently oppose. It really operates only on that basis. It has no power, famously, beyond the power of the written word. So I think that it does indeed have tremendous ramifications if we, in fact, have someone on the court who, before the person's arrival, is identified as somehow inappropriate. The reason why I think his inappropriateness at this time is so, the idea of that is so widespread, is that there is a larger trend in our political system at the moment, in our way of dealing with each other, which some people have called tribalism. Tribalism being understood not simply as interest group differences, because we've always had that and always will have that. There will always be human divisions, enmities, conflicts, and so on. But something different, it's the idea that we're identifying with self and clan over the interests of the broader society. And of course, the current president in some ways might be said to celebrate tribalism, but it's certainly not new in politics, but it is new in a nominee to the Supreme Court. I think that what has alarmed a lot of people really was Judge Kavanaugh's performance before the Senate committee, where it seemed that this instinct of self-protection, the family or the immediate clan being the only group that really has personal loyalty or ultimate meaning, that message was radiated during that testimony, when we really normally would expect to see some acknowledgement by a judicial nominee of the needs of the larger society, some kind of assurance about adhering to ideas of truth and justice when dealing with others, even one's enemies, and so on, because the Supreme Court really is our last resort. It's the one institution that is supposed to stand up for the politically unpopular, the dispossessed, protection from existential threats that we face, and so forth. And the idea of someone in that position who doesn't share that larger vision is very troubling. So I think, in a way, it's not just this one individual who is creating or is sort of the center of this crisis. It's the idea that we have a larger political and institutional crisis going on when it comes to this celebration of tribalism. And this is just one piece of the puzzle.
We're going to go to the phones right now. Al called 651-227-6000, or maybe he called 1-800-242-2828. I don't know which. It doesn't matter, because Al is on the line from Eden Prairie. Hi, Al.
Good morning. I just have a quick comment, I guess, I'd like to make it to your guest to respond. I have to believe that this really obviously didn't start this week or this month. This has been going on for years. In recent history, the one that comes to my mind the most, I would have to say, would probably be Robert Bork. We've got a new, was it verb or adjective, whatever it is now, saying you've been borked. So I believe, I'm not a scholar at any stretch of imagination about the Supreme Court, but I've got to think that this is nothing. I mean, yes, it's getting worse, but this is nothing really new. I heard something mentioned on NPR that this is the first time in 80 years that he's confirmed that the Supreme Court's going to be leaning conservative. So I guess I can understand some of the fervor going on, but I don't think it's anything really new, except maybe for the pitch and the social media and the communication that's happening nowadays. What do you guys think?
Aziz, what do you think?
Well, Al had a couple of things that he picked out as not new, and let me try and disentangle those, because I think he's right about some of the things, having long-standing precedent, and I think there are some things that are distinctive here. So the first thing that he said is, well, look, there's been conflict over Supreme Court nominees for a long time. And that's right, and it goes back a lot earlier than Judge Bork's nomination. Indeed, there are, depending upon how you measure the time frame, something like a quarter of Supreme Court nominees over time that are put forward by the president are either voted down or withdrawn when they reached the Senate. And so that the idea that there would be conflict over the Supreme Court in the Senate and that that conflict would play out over partisan lines isn't new. The idea that the court is pivoting to the right, I think, is a common trope, but I think it's overplayed by both people on the left and the right. If one looks at empirical studies of where the court is in relation to where it has been historically, it is already very, very far to the right in comparison to both the preferences of the historical court and I think the preferences of the general public. The Kavanaugh appointment moves that needle on a couple of issues, most importantly abortion and perhaps the use of race in certain contexts. But the fact that I think both the left and the right miss is that the court is already a relatively right-of-center institution in comparison to the present spectrum of American politics. And while it's true it could get further to the right, there's just not that much further it can go without slipping into outright partisan territory. So I think that that's not something that marks this point out as being distinctive. You know, what I do think is distinctive is the fervor and the intensity of the partisan responses to the it wasn't just the Kavanaugh nomination, but it was the allegations of attempted rape by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and maybe that is that allegation and the responses to that are the really interesting and new part of what's happened over the last few weeks.
Laura, what did you think of Al's idea that this is the same old, same old? We've seen this before, and this isn't that new.
I think it's I think he's definitely right that there have been serious, contentious debate about prior nominees, and he's also correct that many, or Aziz also, that many of them withdrew as the result. I think that so. Indeed, it's partially certainly correct. What's different this time? Several ingredients that make it different this time. The first one is that, as a general proposition, we are in a highly politicized moment in American history, a bitterly politicized moment. This isn't, if this had been an appointment by George Bush or something like that, there may have been a lot of discomfort on the part of the left that this person might rule in certain ways that would be undesirable, but there wouldn't be this predisposed political atmosphere of hostility and rage and people aren't listening and, you know, all the ingredients that have gone into. And by the way, I would say this is definitely a failure to listen is a failing on the left and the right. It's by no means something that the right has simply done. In some ways, Trump did listen to a lot of the white working class, which the left had refused to effectively listen. So, you know, but this the entire time right now is one of people not listening. And now we have the Me Too movement and people again aren't listening. You know, that's the deep message. And now we have, in the view of many, these senators aren't listening, you know, and there's a very heightened emotional nature of this particular political moment that I think is crystallized into this nomination and will go forward and potentially damage the court if indeed, if either happens, it might, but particularly if someone is placed on that court who is viewed as an unabashed partisan, which is unfortunately what many saw in his testimony.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. We are discussing politics and the Supreme Court right now. My guests are Laura Underkuffler. She's a law professor at Cornell Law in Ithaca, New York. And Aziz Huq is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. He's the author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. And I want to hear from you. Do you think that the Supreme Court can stay above the political fray? Do you think that you are losing, have you lost any faith in the Supreme Court? Call 1-800-242-2828. Or 651-227-6000. Jason has called from Forest Lake. Hi, Jason.
Hello. You know, I kind of wanted to talk about some of the procedural changes that happened in the Senate, which is adding to the divisions. When Barack Obama was president, he was appointing lower court justices, and Mitch McConnell basically blocked everything he was trying to do. So Harry Reid, in exasperation, changed the rules so that it required just a simple majority to confirm a lower court justice. That continued into the Trump era. Now, Donald Trump is appointing lower court judges, and they're just getting passed through left and right. He's just stacking the court that direction. But Mitch McConnell changed the rules for Supreme Court justices, so now it only requires a simple majority. When Kagan and Sotomayor was confirmed, it required 60 votes. Right now, it only requires 51 votes. So I think that's really adding to the divisions in this country and the contentiousness of these nominations. That's
great.
My comment.
Thank you for calling in, Jason. Aziz, do you think that having a simple majority has made it more politically fraught than it would have been if we still needed to get two-thirds vote?
I think it's helpful to step back and ask why the judiciary has become so politically fraught. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for that. And here, I think my position is a little different from Laura's, although I may be inferring too much from some of the things she said. In my view, the court has to take decisions that are often not determined by prior law, precedent, or constitutional text. The reason that an issue divides lower courts and percolates up to the Supreme Court is that reasonable people can differ on the way that the law directs one to act. And in those cases, particularly constitutional cases, there are inevitable questions of political morality that have to be brought to bear. So the court, in my view, is situated so that it is inevitably deciding questions of political morality that often have a partisan complexion. And that's been true through the beginning of the American Republic. It was true when the court handed down cases like Dred Scott v. Sanford, right? The case that attempted to settle the question of the status of blacks in the United States prior to the Civil War. So the court itself is deciding questions that, on one view, are political in nature. And what's happened, I think first on the right, but then on the left, is that there are a slice of questions that predictably come in front of the courts that are of great interest to parts of a partisan coalition. So the best example of that is abortion. Mm-hmm. Abortion became something that was of vital and central interest to religious and evangelical groups, particularly on the Republican side. With respect to many of the Republicans' donors, there are issues about the court's treatment of business and the possibility of exposure of corporate interests to large-scale liability through things like class action that are also of great interest. Right? The left over time has come to have another set of issues that concern it with respect to the court, but I think they came later to the game and have been much less effective in organizing politically. So in that context, where the court's deciding political issues and those political issues are entangling pieces of the Republican and Democratic coalition, they're picking up things that the Republican and Democratic coalition really care about, I think it is incredibly unlikely that the court would not have become politicized in the way, or it would not have become the
object of political fights in the public sphere in the way that it has now become. And while I agree with the caller's description of the way that the Senate rules have evolved over time, I think that what he's describing is not a cause of the court's polarization, of the court's seeming politicization. I think it's an effect of the kind of issues the court is deciding and the way those issues have been hitched to interest groups on the right first and then on the left.
Laura, does that sound right to you? It's a chicken or egg question, I guess.
Right. Well, I would say that the court has always decided politically highly contentious issues. Yes, indeed. They are always faced with questions of political morality or fundamental values or however you want to place it. Cases that are not, I mean, there are some cases that don't deal with those questions, but usually those kinds of questions are involved. Otherwise, it would not be at a case in the Supreme Court. So, but that truly has been the case for from the time that the court was founded. It was a controversial issue, whether we're talking about the New Deal struggle or we're talking about the slavery struggle or various other issues. So the political nature of it is not something that is new. I think that what we're dealing, that the particular item that has become more, that has enhanced this, as I mentioned before, is the political climate that exists generally, and the fact that we have a nominee who has now apparently indicated that there are large parts of the political spectrum and so forth, Democrats, Clintonphiles, whoever you want to call it, who are he views as personal enemies. That's a different kind of situation in my mind. And on the caller's question about the supermajority, I think, yes, I mean, this is one of those situations where, you know, it's instrumental. The left decides that they to get their appointees through, they're going to require only a bare majority, and then it comes back to bite them, of course, when the other side becomes powerful and decides to do the same thing with the Supreme Court. But that issue, I think, is actually very important because, actually, if the governmental apparatus, the president, whoever it is, the powerful senators involved, know that they must, in fact, get a nominee through by a particular kind of vote, that is going to force some kind of moderation, at least to succeed, it's going to force some kind of moderation in choice. And with the absence of that, yes, I think that the caller is correct, and the door is open to a different calculus, a different political calculus in this process.
This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis. I'm sitting in for Carrie Miller. We are talking about the Supreme Court and politics and whether an impartial Supreme Court is something that you still believe in, that the people still believe in. My guests are Laura Underkuffler. She's a law professor at Cornell Law, and Azeez Huq, professor of law at the University of Chicago and the author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. I want to go right to the phones. Our phone number is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And we've got John in Delano on the line. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going, Stephanie? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just want to say that I have a tremendous amount of faith in our Supreme Court, in our judicial system, absolutely in our Constitution, although that was recently threatened by the lack of presumption of innocence. I think that the Democrats have gone completely crazy. I used to be a Democrat. I will not be voting Democrat. I'm just going to go Republican all the way down the line. And I'm embarrassed by Amy Klobuchar, absolutely embarrassed. Because people aren't giving anybody a chance. Mm-hmm. It's like we have turned against each other. It's brother against brother. It's sister against sister. This is really bad climate that we're in right now. We've got to look to the other side. We've got to look at their qualifications. We need to listen to people, not just judge them. I think it's a really, really sad situation what's gone on. I'd really love to hear your opinions about that.
Thank you for calling in, John. Laura, what did you think about what John had to say?
I think in some ways he hits the nail on the head. Mm-hmm. I think that there is definitely an atmosphere of circling the wagons, only I think it's actually by both sides of the spectrum, but I think there is a feeling that there is no listening to others. There's no relevance of others, whether you're talking about people on the right or the left. It's simply an idea of setting up a barrier around your particular group, and there's no desire to engage anyone else or to make any inquiry into why they are thinking what they're thinking or anything else, this kind of tribalism. So I think that, yes, the right at the moment are the ones who are generally more vilified for this, but as the caller notes, the left has a lot of elements of this. Also, I'm not sure that I completely agree with the individuals he mentions, but there's definitely that kind of idea. The intellectual elite is not interested in listening to people who are not part of the intellectual elite. The unfortunate phrase, basket of deplorables, was a great example of that. And we're therefore caught in a situation where everyone is becoming more and more entrenched in these views of hostility, anger, and so forth. I think he's got an excellent point. Now, how we translate this into the treatment of a particular Supreme Court nominee is a very difficult question. And I guess there, I think it's unfortunate that the nominee seemed to adopt this kind of approach himself in dealing with the questions, although obviously they were very difficult personal questions. It would have been reassuring to have heard something more about his ability to transcend this if and when he was appointed to the court. But I think that the caller is correct.
Aziz, usually the job of a nominee for the Supreme Court when they're going before Congress is to say as little as possible about their views. Were these fissures just exposed this time and they've always been there? Or do you think that there is something different about the Kavanaugh nomination?
I think that the Kavanaugh nomination, as initially framed, was pitched on the basis of the candidate's character and personality and formal qualifications rather than the views that he's expressed in earlier opinions and in earlier law review writings. I think that reasonable people can disagree about whether the views that he expressed in those opinions and those writings were consistent with the Constitution, with federal statutes, or were the best reading of those materials. The way our confirmation process has developed, however, nominees tend not to talk about how they would resolve difficult and contentious questions of constitutional law. Those questions don't answer themselves. They have to be answered. And instead, the nomination process has proceeded by focusing upon other elements of a candidate's profile. And in Judge Kavanaugh's case, the case for his nomination and confirmation focused upon his character and treatment of others, the mentorship that he provided to law students, his involvement, for example, in his kids' sports and the like. And those elements of his character, I think, were well-aired and were articulated clearly by both people who supported him because they agreed with his substantive positions, but also people who didn't support him based upon his substantive positions. He had many supporters, particularly in his former alma mater, the Yale Law School, who don't agree with the substance, and he said, look, this is an honorable guy of great character. I think the
that the what's new about the Kavanaugh nomination and what the caller picks up on is late in the day, an accusation that went directly to those questions of character arose. And what's happened, and I think the caller illustrated this as much as he criticized this in the way that he framed the behavior of both sides. What happened with that question of Dr. Ford's accusation is that there was a deep and very, very quick polarization of views about how to deal or how to navigate questions of sexual misconduct. And that underlying question, the question of what one does with respect to sexual misconduct, is a very difficult one in the ordinary course of things. And its difficulty was exacerbated in the context of a high-profile proceeding like a Supreme Court confirmation. The difficulty was not so much that there's a presumption of innocence. That's a concept that's used when someone is potentially subject to criminal penalties. Judge Kavanaugh is applying for a job. There is no presumption of innocence when one applies for a job, so I'm not sure that's the right way of thinking about things. Rather, there is a deeper question of what happens when an incident of alleged sexual misconduct occurs, usually away from other people's eyes, and there are competing accounts of the events from usually the man and the woman. And what's happened in the Kavanaugh nomination is that disagreements that were percolating about this question about sexual abuse, and the way that it gets treated in the public sphere have become sharply and deeply polarized. And you know, whatever else the nomination's effects are on the court, one of its clearly pernicious effects has been to make the question of sexual violence and predation a partisan question.
Let's go to the phones. Terry in West St. Paul has been waiting patiently and has a point that I want to hear. Hi, Terry.
Hey, you know, we're obviously in the middle of a constitutional crisis. 18 years ago, we were certainly in one with even more serious consequences when the Bush-Gore basic tie happened in Florida. And after the Supreme Court ruled against Gore, he graciously conceded to President Bush in the interest of keeping the country together. I think Brett Kavanaugh has every reason to withdraw his nomination. There's certainly other very qualified candidates. His life is not ruined. There's many jobs he can have on Fox News and other university teaching law or practicing in a law firm. And this would help draw the country back together again. There are certainly many people on President Trump's list that could fill that position. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Terry. Laura, do you think that is this a constitutional crisis?
I think it's a constitutional crisis in the sense that our image and our view of the individuals who sit on the court is being seriously challenged because we have never, the Clarence Thomas situation is a good example. Justice Thomas, there was a very contentious hearing about something not as serious as this, I guess most would say, but nonetheless of the same type. And he was elevated to the court after a contentious vote, and I don't believe that that caused any long-term damage to the court. I don't think anyone seriously would say that. But this case is different for all the reasons we've been discussing. And so therefore, should there be some other kind of outcome as the caller indicates? Should he withdraw for the good of the country? It's interesting in that this concern for self and group, this what I would call this tribalistic phenomenon that we're experiencing at the moment across the political spectrum, is not one that yields compromise or consideration about larger societal cost, whether it's the left or the right or wherever it is. It's the frame of reference is simply one's own belief, one's own group, one's own trajectory. And so, therefore, it's highly unlikely that in this environment he would withdraw. In fact, it would be seen as weakness, I am sure, by very prominent members in the supporters that he has, that to somehow fold his tent and say he's doing it in the interest of the larger society, this would be seen as some sort of unpardonable and disgusting weakness. So we're in different times, and I think it's swept up this particular nomination.
Aziz, what do you think? Do you think we're in a constitutional crisis that could be resolved if Brett Kavanaugh just stepped aside, or Democrats just voted for him and put him on the bench, and it would all be solved if we just went our ways and acted like it didn't happen?
I think that our constitutional system is under great pressure from what Laura called tribalism, and I guess what I would call extreme partisan polarization. And that's a systemic problem. And it's a problem that the framers did not anticipate. So very famously, James Madison, in arguing for the Constitution and the Federalist Papers, said, look, the benefit of the system that we're creating is that you're not going to have national-level political factions merge and act in ways that are undesirable. Yet within less than a decade of writing that, Madison was instrumental in the creation of one of two major political parties. The Constitution is not designed to operate in a world of political parties. It has always operated in a world of political parties. But there are certain conditions of party polarization that make governance extremely difficult. And if one wants to talk about a constitutional crisis, I think it's that deep conflict between political polarization and a set of constitutional structures that are not designed, that are concededly not designed for conditions of high partisanship. That's the root of the problem. My sense on the question of whether Kavanaugh could or would or will withdraw is the same as Laura's. I think that that's extremely unlikely. I think that given the scope of the FBI investigation, it is exceedingly unlikely that the FBI investigation will in fact yield much new material light on the allegations that have been made. I think that the strategy of withdrawing and putting forward a different candidate, arguably an even more conservative candidate, such as Judge Amy Coney Barrett of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, would have been actually a politically very, very savvy move on the part of the Republican Senate and White House a couple of weeks ago. But given where we are today and given the political hay that that both parties are now making of the hearings, and I'm thinking in particular of the president's mockery of Dr. Ford in a Mississippi rally yesterday, I think that Laura's absolutely right that the dice have been rolled, and we have what we have.
We're going to go to the phone lines now. Sarah in Motley has called. Hi, Sarah. What did you want to talk about?
Hey, good morning. Well, your guest had talked about how this was a last-minute question of character that has come up and sort of disrupted the proceedings, but you haven't talked about why this is so last minute that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership sat on this story for 8 weeks and did nothing about it, using this woman as a campaign tool instead of giving us an additional 2 months for a thorough investigation for anything that she says she wants to see. We could have been working on this months ago. And it seems to me that it's biased on your part not to mention that as part of this discussion.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Sarah. What do you think about that? Has the process, Aziz, is it just a bad process where, I mean, whether the Democrats were concealing this or not, just the amount of time they put into it. It can either be a six-week confirmation. You know, they keep going back and comparing how much time the FBI spent during the Thomas hearings. It's a strange and awkward process that doesn't seem to be very clear.
I agree with the caller that it's an undesirable process. I disagree with her claim that this is sandbagging by the Democrats. My understanding of the facts is that when Blasey Ford disclosed by letter her allegation to Senator Feinstein, she also requested that that letter be held in confidence. She requested that it not be circulated. My understanding that it was shared within the Senate, and Blasey Ford's hope was that the investigation that was being done would persuade either Judge Kavanaugh or the White House that the risk of this becoming a public issue would counsel in favor of a different candidate, and that she would not have to go through the extraordinarily painful and harmful to her family process of having to step into the public spotlight. I think that those views on that preference for privacy that Dr. Ford had was honored by the Senate Democrats, and only late in the day, when it was apparent that the disclosure of the alleged assault would not, within the Senate process, but not to the general public, was having no effect, only then did a California House Democrat, who is the representative in Blasey Ford's constituency, disclose the information. So I am not persuaded that there is that there was ever an effort on the Democrats' part to engage in sandbagging. It strikes me as implausible, because it would have helped the Democrats more to raise this issue earlier and to frame the initial confirmation hearings around questions of sexual predation rather than the way they were focused. So they have, both then and now, no political reason to withhold the information in the hope that they could sandbag Kavanaugh later on. It is not consistent with any kind of sensible political logic. And then the notion that there is a problem here that forces a limited investigation is, I think, a troublingly partisan one. It is true that the Supreme Court has 8 justices rather than 9 justices at the moment, but the court's had 8 justices, not 9, many times in the past. Indeed, there was a long period after the death of Justice Scalia that the court only had 8 justices. That doesn't prevent it from operating in any meaningful way. The only time deadline here is the election. The only time deadline here is a partisan one. There is no reason outside of partisanship not to have a thorough investigation of all of the allegations that have been brought forward at this point. So the notion that the Democrats withheld information, I think, is belied by the facts and is not coherent as a count of political motives. And the notion that now we are at a point where there is some objective reason for not having a complete investigation is, I think, a false one.
Let's go to Rush in Anoka. He called in to 651-227-6000. Hi, Rush.
Good morning. I want to start out with saying I don't think this is a constitutional crisis. I think this is a crisis of confidence. And I'll give you, I am a conservative in more of the mold of Barry Goldwater, but I don't hold his racist views. I hold his views that one should try to be self-sufficient. And on, as far as the court in any country is merely another political venue. And that depending on who has controls of the powers in the country, which way it is tilting, that one, the court will decide horrific, abhorrent decisions. For example, as the speaker said earlier, Dred Scott, Americans of African descent, and I will not say African Americans because they are Americans first of African descent, mm-hmm. Americans of Japanese descent would not have any confidence whatsoever in the court system, being the what they had to live under Jim Crow, and the internment of Japanese. Now, and then it goes to the other extreme in the George Bush administration, where corporations are deemed as individuals. I'll say one more thing,
okay.
And that is the courts, even the Nuremberg court, was political. The Nazis, I'll refer to the book Hitler's American Model, the Nazis modeled their oppressive laws by studying Jim Crow laws in the United States and found that some of them were far too oppressive and did not model.
Okay, Rush, we only have 3 minutes left, and I want to give our guests a chance. Thank you for calling in. Laura, is it possible, is the ideal of the Supreme Court being non-political just an ideal and something they're moving toward on the horizon, or is it possible for it to be non-political?
I think the caller is correct when he says that effectively, it is merely another political venue in the sense of the decisions are going to, at any given time, are going to favor one particular set of values shared by one segment of society and not those shared by another. The only qualification, and I think it's an important qualification that I would give, is that we as a society either accept that that goes on and we nonetheless concede the legitimacy of the court in other ways, or we don't. And if we look in the United States, we've in many ways had a charmed existence. We've never really had a fundamental breakdown in public belief in the authority of the court, even though it was seen as another political institution in many ways. But in other countries, including Western countries, we have seen that. So it's a little... I see it as a little more complicated, but I think he is correct that for us to say that it's somehow non-political when it's filled by this process and when the decisions by definition are going to be seen as political because they're going to favor one group over another would be naive.
Aziz, what did you think?
I want to admire and commend the caller for being very clear about his own where he stands in terms of his values, and in recognizing that over time people have come to our Constitution with different values, and they have argued with the Constitution for some of their values. And we recognize today that some of the things that people have pressed the Constitution into service of, slavery and Jim Crow most obviously, also the Japanese-American internment, are, by our lights, abhorrent. I think that the lesson in what he has said is that, first of all, we need to recognize that our values matter when we think about and look to institutions like the Constitution and the Supreme Court. And second, we've got to recognize that we are part of a large and diverse country where people have very different points of view and different values. And, I probably don't agree with the caller on many things. I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination, a conservative. Mm-hmm. But I have enormous respect for his ability to say, look, here's where I stand, and here's what I see that's good in the Constitution and its history, and here's what I think is troubling. And I think that more people coming to politics with that openness, both about their own values, but also about the fact that other reasonable people have different values.
All right. I've got to cut you off there, Aziz. I'm so sorry. Aziz Huq is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, and my other guest, Laura Underkuffler, is a professor of law at Cornell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.